Earlier this year, Tropicana Orange Juice got a multi-million dollar makeover. The company canned its familiar logo with the candy-striped straw sticking out of an orange and replaced it with a simple picture of a glass of OJ. But if you blinked, you might have missed it. Tropicana's fans revolted. The new package is history, which raises some questions. Why do you buy the brands you buy? Is there one brand loyalty you've never been able to shake? And if so, can you explain it? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at npr.org/talk. Scott Montgomery joins us now from member station WFYI in Indianapolis, where he's executive creative director at Bradley & Montgomery, a branding and communications firm. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks, Neil.
And, of course, this is just the most recent example of a redesign flop. I guess the most infamous one is New Coke. Where did Tropicana go wrong?
Well, you can convince yourself, I think, in those meetings that you have a very logical system. You know, you're being presented to by people with a lot of experience. You've got a lot of data to back stuff up. You're usually talking to focus groups and things like that. And you may sort of see in all that data, things that you think are a win that are actually not the most important thing when you actually get in the store and see it. Someone might say, you know, I love the little cap on that. One of the neat things about that Arnell's packaging for that product was they made the cap feel like an orange. You squeezed it. It had a texture of an orange. And I would imagine when they showed people that people went, wow, that is really great and clever and awesome. And so the data probably came up and said, hey, that's a win. This is a great packaging design. And then when it actually got on the shelf, people couldn't tell one from the other. The typography, kind of one flavor looked like another flavor. And a lot of people thought it looked generic. And so I think the important thing is that people could talk to each other you know, through blogging and through social networks about it in kind of revolt en masse as well as rejecting it on the shelf. That's probably why it happened faster.
You mentioned Arnell. It was Peter Arnell who's the guy who said, you know, this is a great idea. Let's spend the $35 million.
Yeah, he has had some great successes in his career. He's also, you know, one of those guys that has done some things that are controversial, and sometimes he wins and sometimes you don't win as much. Obviously, he was involved in the Pepsi redesign as well.
Well, you go through a number of different products, and in fact, Pepsi and Coke are both redesigned their cans, but they didn't change the logo.
Well, Pepsi changed the logo in a way. They went through an elaborate branding investigation. And what it came down to is that different flavors of Pepsi now have different levels of smiles. So if you've got like a big high caffeine version of Pepsi, it's got a really big smile on the logo. The whole white part of it opens up hugely. And then if you've got the low calorie version, it's just a little tiny smile. And it's supposed to engage you. The logo itself is similar enough to the old Pepsi logo. I don't think it's going to confuse anybody. But I think a lot of people looked at that endeavor and the amount of money that kind of got you there and were surprised by it. I happen to like the can itself. I think the can is simple and blue and really stands out on the shelf in a retail way, in a way that the old package that was covered in little doohickeys and swooshes and lines and all sorts of stuff like that really didn't. And Coke did a similar thing, too. They've taken it back to simplicity as well. The Coke can is very, very simply red and almost devoid of extra marketing, you know, doodads. And I applaud that. I think it makes for a more compelling package on the shelf.
You used an interesting word, and that is engagement, that the way these brands are conceived, they're supposed to engage us consumers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're supposed to. The reason that anybody does this at all, I mean, the reason that you take a package that is sold well for, you know, 100 years and change it is because you have to create some news around the brand. There's a lot of ways to create news around a brand. I mean, you can run an ad campaign. You can have a celebrity use it or not use it. You can do all sorts of things like that. But one of the ways to make something new without changing anything on the inside of the package is to change the package.
Change the package. Though, as you also point out in a piece you wrote, in perilous economic times, there are risks associated with this.
Yeah. I mean, the whole reason is if you're seeing something changing yourself, some sort of external influence that is changing your customer's behavior, all of a sudden their paychecks are different, or there's some other reason that they're not doing what they used to do, you either have to change something about what you're doing in order to either get them back, get them interested again, something. And they're relatively, especially on a product like Pepsi or anything where there's a lot of risk about changing the product itself, like New Coke.
A la New Coke, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, changing the product is perhaps the riskiest thing of all to do. But the thing that you can do to create news is to say this is part of a new almost movement. And, you know, one of the things that Pepsi's always been about has been about sort of harnessing this idea of youth, and we're younger and we're sweeter maybe, but we're mostly younger, more energetic than the Coke people. And this is really just the newest expression of it. I mean, you can see it in the advertising with all the, you know, the bright colors and the adjectives and how they express themselves. It really is about going back to their roots in a lot of ways, about being the youthful brand.
The Pepsi generation.
Exactly. It's really the Pepsi generation all over again, but it's done in a way now that I liken to sort of the Obama identity system that Obama used for the campaign. Hmm. You know, it's similar. It's red, white, and blue, big field of blue, clarity in presentation. Everything about that, you can sort of see the Pepsi people going, you know, look at that. They look like they know what they're doing. They look like they're a new generation. This is about change. This is about adopting a new attitude. We should do something like that. Yeah. We have the raw materials ready to do it.
We're talking today about what brands you buy, why you buy them, and can you figure out why that is? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's start with Stephen. Stephen with us from Berkeley, California.
Hi. I'm glad I ran into this conversation because I actually have a small branding firm, and I looked at that change in the OJ, and my wife's reaction was, where did the orange juice go?
Yeah.
There's this clear, simple, intuitive connection to a brand which is represented by simple things, color, shape, a form, and you're not even thinking when you're buying. Like for me, it's Fig Newtons. You know, I just have to see that package, and I go for it. And to me, those are like brand touch points. And like what you just said about Pepsi, Pepsi kept the key touch points, but they said, let's shake it up and throw it out again and make it exciting for the next generation here.
And
you can do it perfectly, or it can be a disaster. And it's the simplicity of that connection that's so critical.
Stephen, I assume that some point in your life you have encountered a Fig Newman, as I have. And I think Fig Newmans are fresher, they taste better, and I still buy Fig Newtons.
Yes, exactly. That's why I buy them. So if they changed their package and I had a hard time finding it, I'd go, well, what happened here? Or if they did what with Coke did years ago, come up with a new formula, which changed the flavor of the core brand, there was a whole rebellion around that, I remember. And consumers know what they like, and they want to stay with those things. And I think that's really critical.
Stephen, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
All right.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Penelope in Pocatello. I buy Heinz ketchup. I've bought it my whole life. It simply tastes the best. I've tried others from time to time, and I'm always disappointed. My younger brother and I had a knockdown fight in a grocery store one time because he wanted Hunt's. He only won because of brawn and obstinance. I will only buy Heinz. And this is one of those products that you write about in your piece, Scott Montgomery.
Yeah, it is. It's almost political. Ketchup is so strange. The degree that people have an opinion. We even had a problem. When I was growing up, there was a difference even in spelling. Some people spelled it catsup and some people spelled it ketchup. And the whole identity around it, particularly the you know, with Heinz and the Keystone, and to me it had the 57 varieties and the pickle on the bottom, and I always thought that was odd because there's no pickles in the ketchup, but so why is that on there, and why does it work? So it did create a little mystery.
And they've taken the pickle off.
It is true. Yeah, we actually we had a big talk about that because. That was a differentiator in a way. I mean, it was a promise about – matter of fact, I don't think anyone even knows really what the 57 varieties were. I mean, I would imagine maybe 2% is we should throw it out to the callers. What was it? 57 varieties
of? Yeah.
Yeah, but the problem is almost everybody they've moved to putting a juicy tomato on the front of the bottle, and it seems perfectly logical. And it's the same way that the Tropicana packaging, they logically put the juice really large on a corner of the package. It made logical sense. But the thing is that everybody in the ketchup space has a big picture of a tomato on there.
Including Hunt, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's not sort of a big differentiator. Do I think it's going to change sales on it? Probably not. But the one thing that did sort of – I went on a factory tour one time when I was a little kid, and at the end of the tour they gave me this little pin, and it was – I think I still have it somewhere. But it's a little green pin with just a pin back that you'd have that was the Heinz pickle. And that was a little connection that I had with that brand. And I don't buy a lot of ketchup, but pretty much every time I do, I still buy Heinz. And there's something probably going way back into that factory tour that connected me to that brand. And so removing that, even though it's a tiny little thing and you probably couldn't quantify and it might not show up on any data sheets or any research, it's a little thing that is a connective tissue that you're probably not benefiting the product by just removing it for no reason.
And 57 varieties was so vague that it couldn't be trumped. You remember Howard Johnson said 28 flavors, and that was easily trumped by Baskin-Robbins. Yeah. And so by being vague, they won the war without firing a shot. Anyway, we're talking with Scott Montgomery about branding and the Tropicana's abandonment of its new look that they introduced in January after $35 million. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Rob on the line. Rob with us from Tulsa.
I stuck with Tropicana's Diet Orange Pop for years. It started in a 2-liter, and then it went in a 16-ounce plastic bottle, and then in a 12-ounce can. And about a year ago, they just stopped making it altogether. And I actually searched that on the Internet. People were selling that for $60 a case. I didn't buy any, but it was a very popular item, and they just tossed it overboard.
And because it was, underground, it was going for premium dollars.
Exactly.
Wow.
And, I never found anything that tasted like it, so I do not buy Diet Orange Pop anymore.
Huh.
There's an interesting thing that is happening with these sort of mini sub brands that are coming back. For the first time in years, you can go into a grocery store here in Indianapolis and you can buy Moxie, which is a cola drink that no one has ever really heard of in 50 years, but you can go and buy it now because it's pretty
disgusting too.
Oh yeah, no, I wouldn't actually recommend it for anyone who doesn't already love it, but you can do it. There are these little bits of enthusiasm that corporations are tapping into now. I wouldn't be surprised if there was enough of a groundswell within the internet and blogging and Twittering community about this product. You might be able to get someone to bring it back as a niche product.
Thanks very much, Rob. Here's an email from Brandy in the New Bern. I think that's in North Carolina. I'm a 29-year-old Southern female who was taught to cook by her mother and mother-in-law. As such, there are certain brands I will not compromise on. They are as much a part of our traditions as the meals themselves. Dixie Crystal Sugar and Duke's Mayonnaise specifically. There simply is no substitute. And this is an email from Anne. A very similar experience happened with HarperCollins and the Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House books in 2007. They kept two editions of the books the same, but changed the lower price paperback edition to photographic covers instead of illustrations. I can't begin to tell you how many customers complained about this change. They did away with those photographic editions last year. And I guess, if they changed the Hardy Boys covers, that would have been a scandal, too.
It's true. I mean, people have almost irrational connections with brands. I mean, these are just companies trying to do business, right? I mean, you would think that this would be a fairly sterile transaction, but people grow comfortable with what they know and love, and when corporations start to mess with it, and if they mess with it without understanding what these customers love about the products and what it kind of connotes about their early lives. They do it at their peril because people really are almost they're enthusiastic about certain brands, and sometimes they're big brands or sometimes they're a way of doing. I got to tell you, I miss terribly the McDonald's fritter pie. Remember the pie that was so hot that if you bit into it, it would damage you?
Yes, I think lawyers remember it fondly too.
Yeah, but I love it, and I would, when they took it away, I went, man, I really miss this, because they tried to substitute with a pie that actually looked like pie. I can make pie. I can make really good pie, but I can't get one of those anywhere in the world now, and I'm a little bit sad about it.
Let's see if we get one last caller in. Susan with us from Lakewood, Ohio.
Hi.
Go ahead, Susan. We just have a few seconds.
Okay. Well, I actually am going to throw out a culturally sensitive one, but always maxi pads.
Always maxi pads, not the generic ones that are a third the price?
No. I know you two are gentlemen, but there is nothing like the name brand when it comes to finding your feminine products. Mm. Generic just does not cut it.
And it's because of the cut of the pad, the thickness? What is it?
I'm not exactly sure. Sometimes it's the roughness, but I've tried other brand name maxi pads, and they just don't work quite as well.
Well,
so I think it's with every woman. They find their brand, they find their niche, and that's what they stick with, because it really isn't so much of a brand appreciation. I mean, I'm appreciative that Always made the pad that they made, but I don't really find it to be something that is. It could have been Playtex. It could have been anybody.
But that's the one you latched onto.
That works for me. And
all right, Susan, I'm afraid we got to go. Thanks very much for the call. And Scott Montgomery, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Scott
Montgomery. Wise words.
Scott Montgomery, Executive Creative Director at Bradley & Montgomery, with us from Indianapolis today. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.